This is Regenerative Skills, the podcast helping you to learn the skills and solutions to create an abundant and connected future. I'm your host, Oliver Gaucher. New Society Publishers is your gateway to a regenerative future. They're not just about books, they're about transforming lives and communities through the power of knowledge and action. Their mission is simple: to inspire and empower individuals to create a more just, sustainable, and compassionate world. They envision a future where every person has the tools and resources they need to thrive in harmony with nature, where communities are resilient and interconnected, and where equity and justice are fundamental principles guiding our collective journey. If you subscribe right now to their newsletter at newsociety.com, you'll be the first to receive sneak peeks at new content and get discounts on upcoming title releases. You'll even get an exclusive discount code on your first purchase of books, ebooks, or audiobooks. So sign up today at newsociety.com. Hey there, everybody, and welcome back. So I've spent a lot of time through the interviews of this podcast speaking with people around the world who are advancing incredible and ambitious projects that aim to regenerate large land bases like farms or estates or even whole regions. Last week's conversation with Verushka Kierkegaard from United Designers is a perfect example of these kind of projects and the potential of collaborative large-scale design. Now that being said, it's such a tiny portion of the population globally that has access or ownership to any land at all, much less many multiple acres or hectares. And despite that, there are countless examples of inspiring regeneration happening at the small scale as well. In particular, the discussion on the Discord community for this show is buzzing with conversations about what members can do and what they've achieved on balconies and terraces, on strips of land between sidewalks and roads, in abandoned lots or small allotments and little yards. And beyond those who are gardening, there are tons of members who are engaged in community work, public service, volunteering and apprenticeships, and other acts of regeneration that have nothing to do with plants or soil. Now, since the main purpose of this show, for me anyway, is to highlight the abilities that any of us can cultivate, regardless of experience or location or access to resources, I really wanted to highlight some of the most active and engaged members of our Discord who exemplify the potential of small initiatives that act as the seeds for transformation, which then blossom into the catalyst for meaningful change in their neighborhoods and their local networks. Today, we're going to hear from three people from very different corners of Europe. There's Catherine in the UK, Bobby in Bulgaria, and Teresa in Estonia. So Catherine describes herself as a stubble-jumping Saskatchewan girl transplanted to London. When she isn't composing choral music, or helping out at the church, or cycling around London, she grows plenty of fruit and veg on allotments, in a churchyard in her back garden, and she likes cats and spaghetti and hates punctures. Bobby was born and raised in a family of generational growers and agrarians. His own family of five lives in the western highlands of Bulgaria on a quarter-acre plot, extended virtually to all of the neighbors' gardens that they've helped to create. A zero-input integrated garden is at the heart of their permaculture, degrowth, and holistic approach to life, growing everything from annual and perennial veggies, medicinal herbs, small fruit bushes, and larger fruit and nut trees. Their main yield is community and resilience via an ever-deepening connection to place and people. And Teresa is an experienced plant enthusiast who has been involved in gardening since childhood. She's lived and traveled to various places around the world, creating nature-inspired gardens wherever she's lived. Teresa focuses on using local natural materials and practicing holistic cultivation methods with an emphasis on growing edible plants, and at the moment, she's growing in Zone 5 in Estonia. Now, all of their different stories and their efforts are a constant source of inspiration in the Discord community, and I know many of you will find ideas and relatable circumstances for them that perhaps larger regeneration projects are unlikely to offer. And with that said, now I'll jump into the panel with Catherine, Bobby, and Teresa. So welcome, Teresa, Bobby, and Catherine. It's wonderful to have you guys on a call again. It's been a little while since we connected on a community call through the Discord channel, which is where we mostly interact. But I'm thrilled to have each of you here today because we're offering a variety of perspectives on something that I haven't explored on the show in quite frankly far too long, partly because I'm getting more larger scale projects, and now that I have a farm and that I work with a lot of farmers in Europe, I don't want to leave out people who are working on smaller scale projects because A, that's where I come from and actually have more reference and more experience in, but also because as each one of you has shown and communicated on the Discord so much in the past, there is almost endless potential that is not dependent on having a large land base to work from. So before we dig into all of these topics, let's go around and give very quick introductions. Just tell us your name so that we can match the voice for the listeners with who's speaking, and tell us where you're based, and then we'll start going into each other's projects from there, okay? So Teresa, why don't you start?
Hello, everybody. I'm happy to be here. Thanks for inviting me. My name is Teresa-Liisa Aasma, and I'm from Estonia. And I grow vegetables in zone 5. We are in latitude 58, which is basically in the same latitude as like South Alaska, so it's quite dark. And we have a small growing project going here where we try to empower people to grow their own vegetables in times when usually people don't grow them, like in autumn and in the winter time.
Marvelous. And Bobby, tell us about yourself and where you're from.
Hello, folks. I'm happy to be here as well. Always lovely to chat with you, Oliver. I'm from Bulgaria, and we live in a village in the western part of Bulgaria, where the elevation is a bit higher. It's like a high elevation valley, about 650 meters above sea level. So it's zone 6A. And we run a small backyard garden and some community projects in the village.
Thank you. And Catherine, tell us about your projects and where you're from.
I'm Catherine. I am a transplanted Saskatchewan girl. I'm Canadian originally, but I live in London, UK. I have no idea what zone it is, probably like 9 or something. It's pretty temperate. I have 2 different allotments on different sites. I grow in my back garden, and I also grow vegetables in the churchyard at my church for our soup kitchen, which I refer to as the soup garden. And I mean, I started out with a back garden, and then I got an allotment, and then there was a pandemic, and it all kind of snowballed very quickly. So I refer to myself sometimes as being on the foodie to subsistence farming pipeline. It's sort of all about the food for me.
Marvelous. Well, that's a really good base for us to start from. And part of the reason why I wanted each of you three on this panel is because we're representing here like 4 different very extreme corners of Europe at the moment. So Catherine in the UK, Teresa in Estonia, Bobby down south on the eastern side in Bulgaria, and then I'm on the Iberian Peninsula. And so with these scattered perspectives, all on all the different things that you're able to do on small land bases, let's go into first why you started your projects and what was the road that led you there. So starting now with Catherine.
So as I said, I'm very much interested in food, and I had a little bit of exposure. My grandparents had a vegetable garden when I was a child, and I loved it. And I would go and I would pick peas, and my grandfather was impressed. And I did once pick 27 onions that he'd only planted out 3 weeks before and got shouted at. That was not so good. He was very sad. I moved around a lot, as many younger Londoners do, and didn't have a garden, and eventually got going in containers and applied for allotment. And my church had a soup kitchen, and I kept thinking, if they're eating, like if I'm eating really fresh food that is homegrown, then the guests at our soup kitchen deserve to also have really fresh food that is homegrown. You know, and we've got this space which is not really being used to its full potential. And surely we could have a few little beds for some beans or some carrots or something. So that's sort of how I got started with the soup garden, and that happened just before I got the allotment. And I got the allotment in December 2019, and then there was a pandemic, and so I started spending a lot more time at the allotment. And what happened is I discovered that having eaten allotment rhubarb. The rhubarb I bought from the shop didn't taste good. And having eaten homegrown tomatoes, the ones from the store didn't taste good anymore. And I've now lost potatoes. I buy potatoes when we've run right out, and I think, oh, well, this isn't so good, which isn't really fair, because by the time I've run out of potatoes, the only ones in the shops have also been stored for several months.
Yeah,
right?
Sure.
They're not at their best. So that's sort of how I got started. Some of the soup kitchen guests help out with the soup garden, which is fantastic. Sometimes it's fantastic. Sometimes they have no idea what they're doing and require quite a bit of support. I'm interested in... I have lots and lots of different interests. The allotments that I inherited don't have amazing soil because they had several decades of getting double dug every year and sometimes some manure added and sometimes not, and quite a bit of conventional fertilizer added. And the site used to be a water meadow, which was a managed floodplain, essentially, where you would flood it in the spring and the silt would feed the soil and then it would be excellent pasture. It does still flood. And so anything that isn't bound up in the soil just washes away and you start over every year. So I've spent a lot of time building up areas that don't flood quite so badly. I have a lot of raised beds, even though I think they're a lot of work and not the right thing for every situation. And B, doing things like digging very deep paths and filling them completely with wood chips so that when the water comes through, I can save some of it in that wood chip.
Sure.
Rather than it all just draining away.
Yeah, of course.
And of course, then in the summer when it's very hot, because it is heavy clay, because that's the only thing that doesn't wash away, we get... I mean, in the summer of 2022, we had cracks the size of my forearm that, you know, you could just stick your arm in there. I lost a carrot down one.
Oh, wow.
So really working on helping the soil along a bit in a situation where I can't control what anyone is doing on the rest of the site. And it's like, I have less than a tenth of an acre on a site that is like 5 acres or something.
So that's and a really interesting challenge, right? So you've got a number of different plots that you manage, all of which have different circumstances and challenges of their own, and not all of them are entirely under your management either. And so though you are able to grow quite a spectacular amount within that confine, there are unique things that you've had to develop to overcome some of the shortcomings and some of the challenges that you've just mentioned.
Yeah, and sometimes it's not what I would do if I had more control longer term.
Sure.
It's very much sort of going, okay, I'm going to have to do composting on a much larger scale than I otherwise might. At the allotments, there are also rules about not leaving your site too messy looking. So there are crops that I grow in the back garden and at the soup garden that are considered weeds. And I don't grow as many of those at the allotment because if they're not in a neat row, someone might decide my plot is too weedy. And then they, I mean, it's not the end of the world. Mostly they just yell at me, but I have to pick my battles.
Nice. Well, I want to come back to some of these unique challenges and solutions that you've been communicating wonderfully on the Discord channel. But let's go to Bobby real quick. Tell me about how you got started on the plot of land and what your original vision was. And I've got an insight into this because you have a fantastic blog and you've communicated some of these things to me in the past. But weave us a yarn here. Tell me about how this all came to pass.
Sure. So I grew on the Black Sea coast on the eastern side of Bulgaria with my grandparents in a village. And I was practically raised in their agrarian ways, so to speak. And at about 15 years, I had a kind of break from that tradition and returned to that thinking and to those ideas 15 years later when I was 30, newly married and with our first kid on the way, which I think here in Bulgaria is a very common pattern. New parents thinking more about the health of the babies and the new life they're bringing into the world and also their families and extended families. They're kind of returning to the pattern of extended family living, growing your own food, social support. I mean, by the community, not by the government. We took down that path naturally. So for a few years, we were looking for any piece of land in an urban setting, not urban in the sense of a city, but where we can build a house. Because here in Bulgaria, it's not allowed to build basically any building in an agricultural or forest land. So we ended up buying a small, maybe a bit more than a half an acre plot in a village close to the capital, but not too close, and built a small house here and started developing our permaculture garden from the first year, even before we had the house built. So we stayed in tents in the yard in the summer. We camped in our own backyard, so to say, and gradually developed not only our own garden, but worked with all the neighbors around to kind of bring them into the loop and make them more aware of what we're trying to achieve, so they are not looking at us with suspicion, as people usually tend to do with newcomers and their weird ways, but more with understanding, and even some of them want to get involved with what we're doing. So that's basically a very condensed version of what we do. Maybe the most important part for us in our garden and in our community is the people which we cultivate along with the plants here. And one of the insights, maybe probably we'll get back to that, but I just wanted to quickly put it out, is that our plot is not large by American or Australian standards, but in effect, our garden is multiplied by each family which we take into the group, because I feel free to just visit anyone, any of our neighbors which we communicate with, and we kind of school them along and use their garden as my own. I mean, not to go and plant there, but our kids can go visit and pick fruit and pick vegetable. We can exchange help. So kind of we're extending our plot virtually by making this like a web of many gardens, which people connect with each other on very friendly terms. So you feel at home everywhere.
That is so beautiful. And I think that is an underutilized perspective when people have, let's say, small backyards or limited growing spaces. Mm-hmm. It's just all the things that you can do when multiplied by community, not only, you know, how much you can share from what you grow yourself, but how that can ripple out into the other homes around you, even some of the public spaces. Catherine, you're using your churchyard, you know, there's so many great examples of this. And this is something I really want to explore more. But first, Teresa, tell me about your background and how you got started with your project.
So I grew up in post-Soviet Estonia, which was rather poor. And I think at that time, most of people or many people grow their own food because of necessity. And it was all mostly organic, at least. My mother grew organic food for us, even though she explicitly didn't call it organic. But and then I think it started from there, basically. For me, it was so natural to have these vegetables that taste good. And later I started traveling when I was an adult, and then I started living in a city, and then I felt like something is missing from my life. And I felt that this was the connection with plants. So I started a garden on my balcony when I lived in Germany, and I started growing my own vegetables there. And then I got really inspired that I started a blog in Estonian about holistic ways of gardening and growing your own food, which at the time nobody really talked about. And it became really popular. I know lots of people have got inspired by this blog. And then later I moved to the UK. I did my permaculture course there, and I was part of many different projects. And then I decided to move back to Estonia and start my own project. And luckily in Estonia, lots of people have access to land. And some people even, like many people have like two plots of land, you know, they live in a town, they have their back garden, and then they have their countryside home, and they have like lots of land to grow food. And at the moment, we try to basically inspire people to start using this capacity they have to grow their own vegetables in a simple way, using all different types of holistic methods. And yeah, teach them the ways they can preserve that food and use in cooking, because here actually people tend not to use vegetables in their cooking very much, or they just tend to not know what to do with them. And yeah, this is what we are trying to do here now. And yeah, to build up our own farm as well, so we can possibly sell these vegetables to the community as well.
That's beautiful. And so one common theme that I'm seeing between all three of you is that food is central, but it's not the bigger vision. Like, food is the tool to bring people together, to recreate a relationship and a reverence for stewarding the land and understanding of our nutrition and the things that bring us together, whether that's cultural or otherwise. And Catherine, I'd love to hear from you, because I know that you do this partly through, like you said, the soup kitchen and the church that you're connected with. Tell me about how that weaves into the religious community that you're a part of, and, you know, how food plays a central role in that.
Okay. How religious do you want me to get?
As religious as you feel comfortable with.
Okay. So I've mentioned once before on the Discord that there's a piece of scripture in which Christ says, essentially, whenever you feed someone in need, however you treat the stranger who needs your help, that's how you're treating me. And I take that very seriously. My church community takes that very seriously. And so when someone comes to us and they need something, we try to help. And I mean, it's a small churchyard, and the soup kitchen currently feeds 45 or 50 people twice a week. So obviously I'm not growing all of the soup ingredients in the churchyard. It wouldn't work, particularly as the churchyard is made of mostly rubble from when they knocked the old church down in the 90s. I'm literally building soil from scratch in a lot of it. But that sense of hospitality, that sense of seeing people as worthy and seeing people as reflections of the divine image, even if at the moment they're having a rough time because capitalism. I won't go off on that rant, but it's, you know, people are treated very badly by the current economic situation and the way that
people's value is tied up in what they're able to earn, right? It's a strange identity.
Yeah,
that we
absolutely
give,
like what is this system where if you don't have money you can't get food, like when there's food right there, and then we throw away so much food,
right?
It's boggling. So part of my motivation is very much that. Part of it is that the people who built the church on that site, they didn't build the church there necessarily to feed people physically, like feed them food, but they built the church on that site because they believed that there would be a worshipping community on that site, and worshipping communities need things like a roof to keep the rain off. And so caring for people's needs in that place is part of our worship. And so part of what I'm doing is, if you like, in faithfulness with the people who built a church on that site. It's using the resources that they put aside, even if some of it is literally piles of bricks. I've been digging a pond and I'm getting all kinds of bricks. It's great. Because I want there to be frogs, because the frogs will eat the snails, and then I don't have to go around with the scissors, which is a gross job, you know. So part of it is a sense of continuity in that place, even though I'm relatively new to that church community. It's a little bit further from my home for various reasons. I felt like it was the place for me to be. And some of it is around, you know, we don't only feed people at that soup kitchen who are Christian. You know, you don't have to be Christian to turn up. You don't have to fill out any forms to turn up. It is completely, if you turn up and you say that you are hungry, we will feed you. And that's also very important because there are a lot of people who, maybe their immigration status is unclear, for example, and they're afraid to go somewhere that they have to fill out lots of forms because they're not sure what's going to happen. So making it a safe space is also very important. And for me, it's a bit of a cliche, but I feel like I learn a lot from that context. I think I've spoken before about we have an invasive weed called three-cornered leek that grows in the churchyard. It's classed as an invasive weed because it comes from somewhere in the Mediterranean and isn't native to Britain. I mean, neither are nettles, probably, but never mind. And you're not allowed to transplant it. You're not allowed to cause it to grow anywhere. But it isn't notifiable. You don't have to eradicate it. And I love that stuff. And the reason is that in about December to January and into February, when there isn't that much else growing in that churchyard, and when people are tired and they're cold, and January particularly, we don't always get as many donations as we would like. And we've got all of this fresh green stuff that tastes garlicky, and you don't even have to peel it. I mean, garlic bulbs are actually really fiddly if you're peeling them before slicing them. So the volunteers love it because you can literally just cut it up with scissors. And there's something there around being willing to work with what you have where you are, not some idealized notion of what should be here. And for me, that feels very symbolic in that we feed the people who are there and need feeding. And the ones who help in the garden, maybe they don't have as much experience and knowledge as I have. And maybe sometimes they dig up something that I didn't want them to dig up. Isn't perfect. But where we are is still valuable and still has worth and still has use. And I don't care what someone's immigration status is if they want to help in the garden. Like, it doesn't matter. They can still learn this is what this kind of seed needs. They can still learn those plants have had enough water and those ones don't have enough. They can still be part of this community. So I guess I get a lot of time because I spend time in the garden reflecting on all the relationships between the different plants and the community, and that also then spills over into how I understand the people that I'm serving. Or maybe it's the other way around. Maybe I wouldn't like the three-cornered leek if I weren't already dealing with a very diverse group of people. I don't know.
I love that reflection. I think that not only is that such a powerful form of service, both the interaction with the land and the results that it has with the people that you're trying to serve, but it also seems like quite a metaphor for the type of worship and the values that you have within your community put into action. And I would love to hear too from Bobby, like, how has your relationship with your land and your community informed the way that you garden, the way that you cultivate things in your own place?
Well, for us, community is paramount, and I have found many thanks to my late grandmother with the gardener family, which I grew. She was a great cook, and I have very high standards for quality homemade food. I never had the fast food or like stuff like McDonald's in my life, to be honest. And my high standards for food kind of spill over around to people which come to visit us and people around. And most of the time, high quality food which we prepare and serve to our guests and to our community come from the high quality ingredients which we pick from the yard. So many times I have lots of examples, but not wanting to take too much of the time. We have people who never planted anything, even didn't grow like a house plant, starting a garden because they want to eat the salad which we are eating in January, which I just shared on Instagram the other day. We had people never expressing any interest in horticulture, growing trees from seed, fruit bushes. I teach them pruning. All this is mainly revolving around food because I see like the fuel of the community. This is what fuels interactions with people. It's always central when people gather. We can't just put an empty table. Even we don't have much and we work on a low budget, there's always something from the garden or from the preserves to serve. And the people are very appreciative of that because in the last 30 to 40 years, those traditions have been somewhat forgotten. So I'm happy that people are appreciative. And most important for us is because we communicate with lots of young families, the ways of the eating habits of the kids change very rapidly when they're in a productive garden. Kids who never eat any vegetables suddenly munching on raw zucchinis they plucked from the bush, which to the shock of their mother usually. And those patterns are really interesting to observe. And at first I thought that change will be very gradual because people here are a bit conservative, but in just maybe 5 or 6 years, there has been massive change in behavior of people, the way they look at what we do, the way there is their perception, their will to grow food, to be part of this whole system, so to speak. And I'm very glad that this whole thing started from a very humble thing, such as a salad or a home-cooked meal, which can really inspire people, not only by bringing some childhood memories from their late grandparents or great grandparents, but also seeing how the whole family is transformed the way they eat. We have neighbors who stop ordering takeout food delivered to their door just because they interact with us more and see that it's not hard or impossible to have your own homegrown food, or maybe not homegrown, but prepared at home. And in a lot of aspects, our cultivation is geared towards that. We have it seed savers. I'm supplying the whole neighborhood here with seed from our garden. We're propagating every fruit bush which we're growing, 20 varieties of honeyberries, 15 of juneberries, currants of all colors, gooseberries. Everything we grow, I propagate in not in like nursery numbers by the thousand, but certainly by the hundreds, which we give away for free to all the people, which I see like a foot in the door, figuratively, because when you have kids who eat only ice cream and chocolate bars and they cannot start munching on the currants, which usually are perceived as tart or astringent, but they just eat them by the handful. You see the parents instantly changing their outlook on how the kids could be fed, what could be their eating habits. So it's very easy to say, this bush, you may not know it, but I have a plant here for you, and just give them like a potted currant bush, 3-year-old, which will be fruiting next year. And they just plant it somewhere in the yard. And next year, they come back for more. Do you have another cover? Do you have something else that fruits later? So this is like, I see it like a regenerative spiral because it starts with something small, but each small action adds up to something bigger and sometimes outside of our control. Because in a few years, I've seen people take grafting, because I do grafting lessons here in the village. And now I see people grafting in the wild, on wild trees here around, which hasn't happened in like 60, 70 years from before the communist times. So our most important mission here is to basically change people via our garden and the way we live and cultivate the garden and the community.
Well, it sounds like you're having an amazing effect over there. And I believe from what you've been saying, it really comes back to a conversation we've been having in the background, is small approachable examples of things that people connect with and can see tangible results of are really the little seeds that sprout into larger actions, lifestyle changes, and reconnection of community. And that's such a powerful example that you gave there. I'm curious, Teresa, in your own work, a lot of the experiments that you're doing are showing that it's possible to get fresh food in a very limited growing season and in a culture that has started to move away from these practices. Tell me about how the response has been from your audience and the people you've connected with.
Yeah, thanks for your question. First, I want to reflect back to Bobby. Yeah, I mean, you were talking about Bulgarian cuisine. It makes me feel hungry right now because I know in Bulgaria you use so many herbs in your cooking. I think it's very
That's
cool.
right,
Yeah.
yeah.
But yeah, so basically here, yes, we've been growing vegetables, salad, kale, leeks, parsley, and Chinese cabbage in the wintertime. And well, part of our project is also inspire people to use more creative ways to cook vegetables and fresh produce, because I think in Estonia it's that people tend to grow a crop if they know what to do with it, because at some point they have so much of this one crop, and I think there are so many different ways you can use it, and people just need recipes and really simple ways to inspire them how to make preserves out of them and just how to cook them in a delicious way. And the moment in the wintertime, yeah, we mainly have greens. And I just like to eat them fresh because I think it is just the best way to eat something that comes directly from my garden right now in the wintertime, because there is not that much of these greens. It's quite precious. You know, I can't really get these greens from anywhere in the country because in the shop, they have salad, but it's usually not fresh, and definitely I can't get the same varieties from there. So I just tend to make salad out of it. Yeah, sometimes I add it to stir fries, especially if it's kale or leeks, or I just try to steam them. But yeah, the main way is to inspire people to cook with one crop because, you know, as I try to eat seasonally, there is like lots of one crop, you know. And I think I have to be really creative to make it interesting for myself. Like, what do you make with leeks for, let's say, 3 months if you have them every day in abundance? So it's a bit of a challenge, but I think it's definitely possible.
Now I'm getting hungry too. I
Well,
just finished my last leeks.
so Catherine, you've also done a fantastic job, and you've also shared a lot of this on the community of the wide variety of things that you are trialing beyond what is conventional or common in the diet in your area. You have unusual varieties of many common plants, as well as ones, like you said, the invasive leeks that people don't even consider eating, but that have, I'm sure, tons of nutritional value and probably need a whole lot less management or fertilization for them to thrive. And being able to capitalize on these things that grow extremely well in challenging circumstances, between that and all of the different little experiments that you're running, where have you found connection with people who otherwise don't know these ingredients or aren't used to using them?
so the three-cornered leek, also known as three-cornered garlic in the churchyard, is the sort of really obvious example there because it's growing anyway. I could pull it up or I could just keep cutting it. I also do a fair amount of urban foraging, and that, I mean, yesterday we had a sort of greens puree that had nettles. It had sand leeks, which are, or sorry, not sand leeks, sorry, crow garlic, which is different again. And Alexander's. And here, like the end of the Alexander's season when they're just coming into flower overlaps with the start of the nettle season. So it's because we're so far south and we have that heat island effect. I think some of it is simply the vast variety of squashes that I have and that I give away because we still have like 19 squashes. And some of those are small, but about six of them are like big, chunky, you know. And talking to people about some of my plans, I'm finding other allotmenters are very interested in some of my tomato land race plans. Now, I'm only a baby land race gardener, I'm just getting started. But what I've been doing is I've been saving seed from the blight resistant F1 strains that I grow. Because on a site with like 180 other plots, we get blight every year, right? And because it's damp, it's partly climate and it's partly just it's a big site. So that's been interesting. And then things like the black salsify that we grow. It's not that often used in the UK, but people see me going to the allotment in December or January and still coming home with an armload of veg and going, oh, what is that? Things like lovage that are not very much work, but give you a lovely crop at a time of year when, the celery isn't ready yet, the Alexanders have finished, but lovage is in season.
Perennial herbs are great.
Yeah, so I grow a lot that way. But talking to other growers, they're most interested in the tomato land race and maybe my potato land race if I get going with that. Although I've realized I didn't leave a spot in my planting plan this year and my seed potatoes are already here. So I'm going to have another year of gathering seeds for true potato seed growing before I get going. And then some of it is simply. I mean, in the soup garden, it's a matter of what will grow. I have limited time there. I'm there on Sunday mornings for a couple of hours and on Thursday afternoons for a couple of hours. And I probably have one person helping me for a couple of hours on one or the other of those. So things like sorrel, which will grow as a perennial and pops up again at this time of year where the more bulky vegetables are quite scarce, that's really valuable in that context. To be honest, when I give the soup kitchen volunteers a big tray full of greens, I think they just probably treat them all like they would treat spinach, and that's fine.
Do
There are things,
you
there
have
are.
some chokes growing?
Sorry?
Do you have some chokes? Jerusalem artichokes
I
growing?
was about to get onto that very thing, actually. I would like to grow more Jerusalem artichokes in the soup garden. I do grow them at the allotment because they're fantastic. They take no work, they produce a lot of food. If I don't want to eat all of it, I can leave it in the ground, you know. I haven't found ones that I can give to the soup kitchen volunteers where they don't go, oh no, we're never going to be able to get all of these clean. They're small and they're knobbly, and it's a lot of labor in the kitchen to deal with them. And so, in a situation where they are trying to make a meal for 60 people, they don't necessarily want something really fiddly.
You
need one of those varieties that make
So what I'm doing at the moment is I'm looking at varieties that are more smooth. And whenever I find a particularly smooth one in at my allotment, I'll take that one out and stick it somewhere and think, okay, this one might do well. Another challenge that we have in the churchyard is that part of it is open to the street. I mean, there's a low wall. And if I grow anything that's too tall, people like to do some things in the churchyard that we would maybe rather they don't do. They like to use some substances in the churchyard that we would maybe rather they don't do. Sometimes they leave some waste in the churchyard that we would really rather they did not do. There are some Sundays where I need to go in and get some gloves and some newspaper and deal with human excrement before I can start picking any vegetables. And that's.
People we
And so.
need, yeah.
So I try to avoid anything that's too tall at the edges because it just makes it feel more secluded.
Sure.
Then people feel safe to do things we'd rather they didn't do.
Well, so that brings me to the interesting and the unavoidable challenges of smaller scale or different contexts of growing that we're talking about. Like up until now, there's the advantages, there's the connection with community that we've mentioned. But there is just no getting around some of the limitations of small spaces, having your plots be in different areas, maybe the shortness of your growing season. Let's just take some time and give credence to the challenges that we're not going to get around that we have to adapt to. Maybe, Bobby, tell me about something that you would like to do but are held back based on your context.
Sure. My main problem is not so much in our own garden because we're slowly working around the challenges here. Of course, the space limitation is always present, but there is ways to work around that. But my main problem is when working with people is that most of the people we work with are on 9 to 5 jobs, so their time span and attention span and their ability to care of their own gardens and what we give them is limited. So we can't expect everyone to be on a degrowth path such as our family. So the way we work around that this challenge is We start people not with tomatoes and cucumbers and the common vegetables and peppers, which are fiddly and they need almost daily care. But we start them with perennial fruit, perennial herbs, perennial small shrubs, and later on trees, and after that vegetables, because I find that the easier it is to get into it, the better. And just right now we talked about this invasive leek. Invasive food is my favorite. You plant it once, you eat it for life. This is the best. Sorrel, nettles, sunchokes. This we don't have this invasive leek here, but we have chives wild, which grows everywhere, which is amazing. And people usually disregard or just don't notice those plants until you show them how they can be used in a delicious way. So our challenge is mainly changing perception and easing people into a lifestyle closer to what we do, but also gradually stewarding their interest towards more and more regeneration, so to speak, more of their attention to be put into how they eat and so on. So what we do is we start with perennials usually, and something quick, easy, and tasty, easily prepared or directly eaten. And besides the limitation in space, which many yards have here, because they're like an eighth of an acre or even smaller, we still manage to, you can plant in very small space, very densely in our climate, and still have decent yields with lots of variety. And this is what we're trying to achieve here with the people which we work. Otherwise, in our own garden, the main limitation is, of course, the space. Also, we work on clay soil, but all those things, I think, easier to fix, even if they're higher up in the scale of permanence, than actually people, which take more time and more, you know, soft skills. You can't just excavate people and change. Yeah. So that's our main challenge. And not to brag, but I think that we're doing okay, considering we're just a few years into this lifestyle and this project.
Oh man, I'll go beyond that. From everything that I've seen you publish, you guys are doing a phenomenal job. And Teresa, tell me about some of the challenges that you're working with that you've had to learn to adapt to.
Well, this winter I realized that nothing can be really grown without covers in the wintertime, basically, because we try to grow leeks and it was working quite well in temperatures like minus 10, minus 15 Celsius. But when it got down to minus 25, they just didn't like it. So yes, I think next year they should be under hoops as well. It would have actually, I think, been fine if there was more snow, but just at the time when it was like minus 25 Celsius, there was no snow. So they were like exposed and they just got frozen. Yeah. And we need to basically work on that. And then, you know, it needs more planning and more preparation, like where to do it, you know, which covers are the best. And yeah, we definitely need to put more thought into that, how to do it in an easier way. And yeah, what is better for us in this farm.
And Catherine, so maybe before telling me about some of the challenges of the allotment system and working on semi-public spaces, can you describe for the listeners what the allotment system in the UK is and kind of how it works?
Okay, so an allotment system, I mean, in the US, you would think of it as a community garden, but what it is, it's a system where local councils have land that they rent out at a very affordable rent to local people for the express purpose of growing food. You're not allowed to sell the food. You're allowed to grow some ornamental plants, but you're not allowed to, say, just lay the whole thing to lawn and put some lawn chairs on it and sit there. You can have a seating area, but it's basically a gardening space for the use of your own household. And different sites will have different infrastructure. Both of the allotment sites where I garden, for example, they have mains water tanks, and it's a dip tank, so you can dip your watering can in it, but you're not allowed to hook up a hose, for example. Both the sites that I'm at have wood chips that are delivered regularly, so you can use those to build your compost or to lay paths on your plot. One of them sometimes has manure delivered, and The other one has manure deliveries, but we have to pay extra for those. They tend to be, I think a full plot is meant to be 16 rods and a half plot is 18 rods. What that works out as is, I think a full plot is about 1/20th of an acre. So I have one and a half plots at one site and a half plot at another, and that adds up to basically a tenth of an acre. And there are all of the problems of something that is run and operated by a committee, and all of the joys of something that is run and operated by a committee. And that's not a problem that is unique to allotments. And I don't get me wrong, I think our committee do fantastic work. They deal with a lot of stuff that I don't want to have to deal with because I just want to grow my vegetables, you know. But sometimes the people on the committee are the people who get some emotional reward from holding that power, and that can cause conflict. I haven't really been on the brunt of that because I'm on church committees, so I sort of figure I'm just going to keep my head down. So that can be a challenge. Another challenge for me with the allotments is that because my nearest allotment is still a 20-minute cycle from my home, and that means that although technically I could apply to have some chickens, I can't really have livestock because I would have to go every day, twice a day, to look after them. And I don't like, you know, if I don't go as often as I should to water my tomato plants, fine. But if I miss one evening of putting the chickens away, that's going to be really bad news. It's just not fair and just not right for me to do that. And so I very often think, man, I wish I had some ducks that could eat some of these slugs. I wish I had, you know, some pieces of this ecosystem that I can see are missing. But it isn't practical. My further allotment is about 10 or 11 miles away. I sometimes cycle up there, but I mostly take public transport and it's a good hour and 15 minutes to get there. So I operate almost a more extensive system there where I have a set number of planting days per year and I grow mostly things that are staples and can be harvested all at once and then stored. I do have a friend who lives nearer who's supposed to help with that, and sometimes they do.
I would imagine all of this takes quite a lot of forethought and coordination. Like you said,
It
regular
does.
maintenance and attendance is not possible. And so you really have to be intentional and coordinated with your time.
I do. And the way that I do that is that I mentioned already for the soup garden, I'm there Sunday mornings after church, sometimes Sunday afternoons if I have an evening thing in the same area. I'm there on Thursday afternoons. That's a set time that I'm there. And anything that doesn't get done in those times, it doesn't happen. With my near allotment, I try to get there one weekday and one weekend day. So Saturday is my usual day at the weekend. And then I'm usually there on Tuesdays, actually. And then that means that because I don't have a day job, I kind of do, but I don't have 9 to 5 hours to contend with. I try to get up to the far allotment at least once a month. But I plan it such that if I don't get there, as long as it stays watered, it's okay. So I have basically two planting days. I'll have one when I go and put in the spuds and the early root vegetables. And then I'll have another in probably mid to late May where I sow squashes and beans and thin the root vegetables and maybe put in some more. And then at the end of September, we harvest all the potatoes, all of the squashes. Hopefully, the drying beans are ready by then, and we can pull out the root vegetables or leave them in and eat them over the winter. But it's a very different way to the way that I handle the other sites where I'm there much more often.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think it's a really good example for people who say that they don't have enough time that you can still produce a decent amount of food. And even if you can only attend to it once a month, if you're coordinated, if you plan things out properly, this can still work. And anything else that you're able to do on top of that once a month visit is extra and will open up new options. I love that.
If I may, just for a second,
Course.
I wonder if Catherine gets enough rain. Of course, in our climate, it's impossible to not water more regularly. Everything will be just desiccated and dead within maybe 10 days. So I wonder if there is ample rainfall to allow
So,
for such cultivation.
yeah, so some things do need more rain than others. I do have friends up nearer that allotment who will water at most once a week. And so, if it hasn't rained for about a week and I haven't been able to get up there, I will say, please, can you go and water? And they'll go and water. One of those friends is a gardener and the other is not. And so, when the one who's not a gardener goes, sometimes things actually get watered and sometimes they don't. The thing I have going for me at that site is that there are a lot of trees around and it isn't very windy. And so, even when it's quite dry, you don't have the wind coming along and just sucking water out of
No
everything.
investigation, of course.
At my nearer allotment, it's kind of in a wind tunnel and it's very windy. It's also in a frost pocket. So, there, what I find is that with some of my more tender crops, I actually have to put like temporary fencing up just so that the wind doesn't dry them out. Both sites have deer, so there's quite a lot of crop protection that has to happen anyway because I'm not allowed to eat the deer. Well, I guess I would be allowed to eat them, but I'm not allowed to shoot them, and I don't have equipment to do so or training, and it's an
Whole
urban
list of
area.
challenges there.
Maybe not the avenue I want to go down. Yeah, one of the things that I want to do on that far site is to set up a solar pump and a water butt so that instead of telling my friend, hey, can you water everything, I can tell my friend, hey, can you check that the water butt is full
Easy
and
task, sure.
save more of our water from the shed roof as well. And this particular friend likes big engineering projects, so eventually we're hoping to have a couple of IBC tanks, which is ridiculous for a half plot, right? But it should mean that we actually get quite a lot of water because our rainfall in East London is quite seasonal. We are actually in a rain shadow and our summers can be very dry. Last summer wasn't too bad. 2022 was very dry. I mean, part of my local park burned, which was annoying.
Well, look, all of these are really good examples, not only of the challenges that people should consider in these contexts, but also creative ways to overcome them. And I was curious too. So, obviously there are some things that you just can't fix or that you have to adapt to, but I would also love to know what it is that you think are the advantages or the really inspiring potential of working at a small scale like this, even though maybe not all of the things that you would want to do are as easy. Bobby?
Okay, so for me, the small scale is the biggest advantage which we get, at least in our context, in here in the country, and especially in the village, is changing people's lives from the ground up and working. This is working practically for everyone. We were growing vegetables when we were living in the city in an apartment on a balcony. We had a worm composting bucket system. So it's very doable on a very limited space and budget and time budget, not only monetary. So the small scale for us is the most, the thing that people can relate to most, because I share in my group videos of people like Mark Shepherd and the Richdale Farm of Richard Perkins in Sweden. And this is all great and very beautiful imagery, perfectly shot, but this is not something that anyone I know can gain something out of it, integrate it in their lives and basically change their course a little and towards towards a more regenerative lifestyle. So when you have someone like me or us as a family, it's more easy to relate to, and the example is very in your face. It's very obvious. You can see our behavior, our patterns, the food which we're eating. So making things relatable and close by is the main strength for the small and micro scale in which we operate. And I think that, as you said earlier, it's those little pieces that kind of shape the whole puzzle of the seeds, which then grow and lead ultimately to a larger change that initially was conceived in that seed. And I think that this is part of the permaculture teachings, that you always are looking to have maximum impact with the minimum input into the system. So this is what the small scale approach helps do.
I love that. Teresa, what about you? Where do you see the opportunities and the inspiration in your area and your project?
Yeah, I think it's definitely the fact that it's very relatable and people can see that, I mean, they can do it too. And I think partly I'm not really doing anything new in that sense. I'm just reminding people all the stuff that has been here before in Soviet times and before Soviet times, and just inspire people that, you know, we can bring the best bits of these past memories like back in terms of gardening and growing sustainably. I'm not romanticizing Soviet Union, just making it sure, but people back then grew their own food. They had like lots of vegetables and fruit in their gardens, and like the whole garden was like maximum capacity food growing, basically. There was no like import from, you know, other countries like there is now. It's just, you know, you had to do this and this was normal. And part of this knowledge is still here in this country. And I mean, I think it's just common sense that, you know, needs to be coming back, because we live in quite challenging times right now. And I think this is the opportunity just to show people that it can be done in small
scale.
People
need to be reminded. People need to be reminded. They kind of forgotten. I think that nostalgia, without romanticizing the Soviet time, of course, from which you also suffered, but the nostalgia, not of the political regime, but of the social structure and the growing of the food, this is something that can be sold, so to speak, to people. They can be inspired by that.
Yes, absolutely. I agree with that. And I think all this knowledge that is in permaculture, it was already here before, but I mean, my grandma never called it permaculture. For her, it was just culture, I think.
Just gardening, yes, of course.
Yeah, and yeah, that's valuable.
I actually want to take some time to go a little deeper into that, because both Catherine and I are transplants from North America to this part of the world, and we don't have as much of a historical connection with the culture of the areas where we're currently residing. Teresa and Bobby, I mean, you know, just like you said, we're not trying to romanticize the hardships of previous generations, but there are a lot of incredible things from those times that are worth integrating into our modern lives. Have you found any things that are just not relevant with the way that we live currently, or is it all adaptable to how we live at the moment? Teresa?
So, I mean, I have this experience of living in the UK, and basically everybody's got their back gardens there. And when I was there, I was like, wow, you got so much land, like in terms of these back gardens. And you've got such an amazing climate. I mean, compared to here, you can just grow so much food. And it would be, you know, it would be so great if people could just use all this land that they have and grow food there, basically, instead of ornamental plants. And yeah, I think in Soviet times, it was very common to just plan out your garden to the maximum, to have a orchard that had maybe like 20 different varieties of apple trees for different times. You would have summer apples, you would have apples that would basically keep in the cellar for the whole winter. Everybody had a cellar around the house. And yeah, it was all like made like so people could just grow a fraction of their own food, at least by themselves in this harsh climate. And I've also come across some research and actually some practical stuff they did in Soviet Union, where they grew lemon trees in like ditches, because it was like minus 15 degrees and then it was just warmer. And it was on industrial scale, just because of necessity, you know. They didn't have any option to like import lots of stuff. So I think there are lots of ways to grow food in this climate, and we just have to find which works best for us. Yeah.
Nice. And Bobby, I know you have dug in quite a bit into the history. I've read some of your blog articles here. Tell me about some of the things that you have connected with from your family's history and your country's history that you're integrating into your life at the moment.
Well, I'll share a short history quickly from my grandparents' past and my forefathers. They were all pastoralists, moving seasonally with the herd from the lowlands, the highlands. And one of the traditional practices with the shepherds was to, while following the herd around the land in specific patterns, all of those pathways which we take, you selected specific wild trees, which we grafted. And that was done generations ago, and each generation renewed those trees. So when you pass with your herd, not only the falling fruit, which were rotting the surface forage for the animals, but also you always get something to pick. My own grandfather, who was a shepherd at 11 years old, it was obligatory to come home with the sheep, also bringing two bags of something which you picked along the road, which is like a grocery store line which was planted and cultivated by your grandfather and so on. So that was very traditional thing here, and even nowadays they're like 300-year-old apple and wild pear trees which are still fruiting, and sometimes you just not walking in the mountains and find this perfect big apple, which is obviously grafted at the chest level because they graft high so animals don't damage the graft. And you can see the graft union and the two different barks, but this thing has been standing here by maybe a couple of 100 years and it's still producing. And this practice, even though it's not really relevant because sadly the number of animals have drastically fallen and the way we inhabit the land has changed, but I'm kind of bringing this back for the people because now people have more leisure time, so we have people walking in the area. And I have started gradually grafting wild fruit trees around walking trails around here in the village. So in different seasons, you have like wild cherries grafted with sweet cherries, wild apples with a couple of variety of apples, hawthorn with queens and medlar, wild pears with regular pears and so on. So what I did is to mimic this this pattern, this tradition's behavior, but make the people which take those routes benefit, not so much the herds because the herds are not present. But that can also work in the other direction, in the build it and they will come way, because now people can deliberately take that route to visit the specific tree at the specific time. So it's nice to also take people out in the houses and bring them more into nature.
Oh, I love that example. And I think it's so important for all of us to remember how much we benefit from the cultural practices and the care that previous generations have put into the areas where we live. And if we don't continue those practices, if we don't maybe adapt or adopt new ones, they're not going to be there for the next generations either. And part of a way of saying thank you for what we're able to harvest, what we're able to benefit from now, is to continue and invest in doing these things for the next generations after. Well, look, we've
Yes.
explored a lot at this point in many different perspectives and different places and practices that each of you represent and exemplify. I would be curious to know what advice you would give to others who maybe are discouraged that they don't have that much land to work with, or that there are other challenges either in the proximity of where they can plant, or the short growing season that they're working with, or maybe a lack of water, which is really my case right now. We're in a severe drought. What would you tell them about the potential that maybe they're not seeing and how to get started? Catherine?
I would say to start where you are and start small if you need to start small. If you start in one bucket on a balcony, that is still a start. And I think that for me, the other big piece of advice would be if you're not sure, then go for diversity. When I sow beans at the allotment, I don't sow one kind of bean because then if that one kind of bean doesn't like the weather that year, I'm in trouble. But I sow lots of types of beans, and I sow peas, and I sow broad beans. And then in a cold, wet year, the peas are beautiful. And in a hot, dry year, the beans do really well. and then I still obtain a yield. And one of the advantages to me of working on smaller scales is that I can do that. I can grow 10 varieties of bean instead of two, and I might have my two or three favorites I come back to every year. So I would say to someone who's feeling like they don't have access to a lot of land, ask about semi-public land. You know, if you go to church, ask if you can have one raised bed in the churchyard and share that food with the congregation. If you don't have much of a back garden, but someone else does, then you can say, hey, can I do some gardening? Locally, we have a little thing where our local transition towns maintain a sort of register of people who want help with their gardens and a register of people who want to garden somewhere. I'm not very involved with that, but I know it exists. And if you start thinking, what can I do with the resources that I do have, rather than, oh, I can't do this because I don't have that, you start to find a way forward and to build a way forward, which might be different than what you expected, and it might be different than what's in gardening instruction books, but which will also be in its way more flexible and adaptable than anything you'll find in the instruction books too.
Sure. There's so much potential in adapting things to how you live, your personal preferences, what grows around you, and all of the other things that make unique context so valuable. Bobby, tell me from your experience, what advice would you give to people to start and maybe even reach out into their communities for the results that you've been seeing?
Well, I have been brought up by the idea that what we already see around us, already present, is only here because someone was, in a never-ending creative cycle. Someone always creating something and adding something on top. So if you have this pause in a cycle, you get from a upwards trajectory to a downwards one. You can, as Alice in Wonderland says, you have to keep running constantly to remain in the same place. So this can be a little bit discouraging, but on the other hand, one of my other main mantra, so to speak, is that one is infinitely more than zero. So even the smallest action is actually infinitely more than not doing anything at all. And if we can grow carrots and lettuce and basil and tomatoes in buckets on a north-facing balcony in the city, anyone can do that. And I think that even a small pot on a windowsill is this one which is infinitely bigger than zero. And those little steps really add up, and it's not as slow and gradual process as most people would think. It won't take so much time when you just keep adding little by little. So my advice is to just start doing things, even if they seem small and insignificant at first, and just marvel at the ripple effect they have, you know, in your life.
Oh, that's beautiful advice. Thank you, Bobby. And Teresa, tell us about some of the little steps and ways to get started that you've seen be effective and have worked for you.
I think it's probably best if people start with what they already have around them, because I think this is a way to like become really creative, because I think there is this paradox. When you have limited resources, you are forced to become creative, and then actually something much more interesting can be born in terms of your garden as well. You know, use these materials that you have in hand and, you know, talk to people in your area and see what they are up to. Maybe you can collaborate. And, you know, maybe you can grow one crop and they can grow another, and then you can like swap knowledge as well. And I think what makes it easier is to plan, because then you don't probably get so overwhelmed. Because I see often in springtime, especially here, because the springtime is really short and all these garden works need to be done in a very short time, people tend to grow too many plants on their windowsill, and, you know, there's only that much space you have. And when you have 100 tomatoes there, there's nothing to do with them. And you already kind of wasted all this resource and time, and then you just throw them away. You know, you're already given away to lots of people around you, and then you still have lots of plants. So if you plan how much space you actually have, then you can just, you know, spend less time doing things that are probably unnecessary, and just, you know, have more time to have fun in your garden.
Well, those are very good points. Now, before we wrap up, can each of you tell me how our listeners can find and connect with you based on the different things that you put out there in the world? So, Teresa, tell our listeners where they can connect with you.
So in social media, people can find me under Metic Aid Holistic Garden. And I have started making videos in English as well, so people can have a look there and see what I've been up to here recently in the wintertime.
Perfect. And Bobby?
I found that small-scale permaculture at YouTube, Instagram, and Substack recently.
Nice. I love that blog you write as well. And Catherine, where can folks connect with you?
The best place if you want to connect with me about gardening is actually on the Regenerative Skills Discord server. I don't have much of a gardening-specific presence elsewhere. And actually, I'm not on a lot of social media anymore. I used to be on more things, but I don't have as much time now because I've always got my fingers in the dirt. So.
That's a very good excuse. And I want to thank all three of you for all of the wonderful insights and stories and advice that you're constantly sharing on the Discord server for this podcast. I have learned so much from all three of you, and I know that the community has been significantly enriched by having you there and having your contributions. So I want to thank all three of you for those contributions and for taking the time today. It was such a pleasure to speak with you. And now we'll go back to chatting on the server.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for inviting.
That was great.
Thanks once again to Catherine, Bobby, and Teresa. I've put all of the links that they've mentioned for their contact and further resources in the show notes for this episode at regenerativeskills.com. Now, before we wrap this up, just remember that these episodes are only the beginning of the learning resources, design and coaching services, in-person courses, and interactive community that are available through Regenerative Skills. The Discord server is our free community where you can connect with other like-minded listeners, exchange ideas, stories, tips, and resources, as well as interact with me directly and quite a few former guests from this show. Our Instagram account, @regen_skills, is the best place to see the projects that me and the team are working on, both for clients and collaborators, as well as on our own properties. I'll also be announcing the certification courses, workshops, and gatherings that we've got coming up later this year. If you're interested in getting dedicated support for your own project, you can now schedule a free planning session with one of our team members through the request form on our website. You can also find all the links, show notes, and past resources there at regenerativeskills.com. We truly believe that no matter your experience, your knowledge, abilities, resources, or background, you can be a powerful force for regeneration on this planet, and we're here to help you find your path. So as always, remember to keep taking those little steps every day towards a regenerative future, and I'll be right by your side along the way.